And for the first time, put myself first in a healthy sense. You know, like before, I put myself first in a very selfish sense, like with the drugs and the alcohol, and you know, like it was always about me selfishly. This was the first time it felt wholesome, you know, like because I had no idea who I was, and I was, who am I outside of my relationships, or outside, who am I outside of being a dad, outside of the work that I do.
And welcome to the Coaching Life podcast, where we peel back the bull crap and brush away any photoshopping to give you an unfiltered look at what it's like to live a coaching life. And really, where I'm taking this podcast, my intention is to give you an unfiltered look at life, my life, life of people that I enjoy having conversations with, beyond the glitz and the highlight reels of social media. And today, gosh, we've spoken about this probably for years. I'm delighted to finally get to record a conversation with one of my favorite people in the world, one of my best friends in Bali, a man, actually, he probably doesn't really know this, but he has had a huge impact on my own life and my own experience of being in Bali when it was home for me. And it's funny saying that because it's like Bali gets under your skin. I'm sure we'll come back to that. This guy, gosh, when I think of him, huge heart. My main interaction with him has been in the gym in the mornings when I was attending the gym in Bali, but also he runs the men's circle that I attended regularly when I was in Ubud in Bali, and I'll share the story of how that came about. He is someone who really understands men, really gets it, what it's like to be a man, understand what it is like to be a man in today's world. He's helped me experience brotherhood in a way I'd not experienced any time before in my life. I think he understands women as much as any of us as well, too. And gosh, he's been an ear and a shoulder for me when I've had things going on in my life. So Dean Powell, welcome to the Coaching Life podcast.
Oh, bro. Thank you so much. It's amazing to be here, and what a beautiful introduction. Can you come with me everywhere I go and just introduce me like that? I love it.
Well, you know, I did have to take 30 seconds to put that together. No, seriously, I mean it. Every word there is heartfelt. I can think of you and I'll tear up. You know, you're like a brother to me, and to have somebody like you, you know, on the other side of the world from where I am, it's truly special. It's precious, actually. To when I, the times I've been, what, back to Bali, is it 3 or 4 times? And yeah, you hooking up with you, meeting up with you, not hooking up in the American sense, but anyway, meeting up with you has been one of the things I've always looked forward to. Yeah.
Yeah, same, brother. Thank you so much.
Let's just dive in first off, really, to instead of doing like the traditional, oh, what's your backstory, who are you, and all that kind of stuff. We're going to come to that. We're going to come to that. Dean, the men's circles. I reached out to you. It wasn't my first interaction with you. We met up, I don't know if you remember, when you were fasting. You did something like a 40-day fast. I'm going to come back to that as well. That's in my notes. But I wanted just this men's circle, this men's circle work that you do, because it's of such incredible value. I reached out to you. I was going through some crap, shall we say. And I reached out to you and I said, I feel like I need a brother who will give me a kick up the arse. And you replied very beautifully, come to the men's circle tonight or tomorrow night, whenever it was, and you can have 10 brothers kick your ass. And it certainly happened that way. What's your story around men's circles? What's your story there, and what had you start facilitating them?
I mean, I originally was very scared of men. Like most of my life, I've been scared of men. I could had a very angry, abusive dad, and not very close relationship with my older brother until we got older. And most men that I came into contact with, I was afraid of. You know, like my perception of men is they're going to hurt me, they're going to take the woman I'm with, or they're going to take my money. You know, So it was a very competitive game, and I felt very easy around women. I've got a twin sister. I hang around with her and her friends all the time. So a very, very good relationship with women. And when I actually experienced men's circles for the first time, it was a very new experience. It was like, oh my God, there's actually something different here. You know, there's a safety in men there, or can be safety in men. I've been to some men's circles where I didn't feel that many times, but the main reason why I do it now is because I need it in my life. You know, like it's very, especially Ubud, Bali is a very feminine place. And you know, like it's an easy place to get lost in the feminine and with the feminine. So having men in my life here, especially like as actually the last men's circle we ran just on Wednesday night, the guys were saying, oh my God, I'm so grateful just to be with men, sharing what's going on in my life with men. There's a magic that happens there. Like even hearing myself say something out loud to a group of men has a magic in it. Like, I don't need to be fixed. I don't need to be healed. I don't need to be changed. I'm not broken, you know, just to be heard. But especially with a group of men, there's a power in that that, yeah, is amazing for me and a lot of guys I speak to.
Every time I share this really for our listeners, because this is pretty much the thing that I've said in closing, you know, as part of the closing, what are you taking away from tonight? And pretty much every time it's always been just that reminder of how we are all much more the same than we are different, right? And it's so easy to, as you say, I love that you've articulated that so simply and so well about Ubud. There's a lot of feminine energy. It's a very feminine place, and it's very easy to live a pretty isolated, lonely life as a man, even though it's like I think Ubud is probably the easiest place it is actually to connect with people, but you still got to do that, right? You still have got to overdo that and overcome that fear perhaps of connecting with people. And I know up until I was started regularly attending your circle, I had very few male friends, if any, really there. Perhaps one that I would just meet up with for an occasional drink. But the depth of the connection, I don't know. I can't put it into words. And you know, there are aspects actually of your circle, Dean, that don't resonate with me, and yet clearly they do with you and with others. And I think that's one of the things I also love about you is your ability. I'm going to use the term, this is like, oh my God, I am going to use the term to like hold space, but really is to be in that space, if you like, of like everything is okay, providing it's not perhaps disruptive or whatever to others in the circle. My first experience of a circle, it wasn't one that you ran, and it was I'd been in Bali for a week. Less than a week, in fact. And I went to one. So this was late October 2019. And just for context, the first one I attended with you was January 21, so a little over a year later. And I just went to this one, and there was one guy there who was very dominant, if you like, in the group, right? And you know, we've experienced that as well. And so again, it's just one of the things I really admire about you is I'm sure that takes a lot of practice, but I want to know how do you deal with that? There's like literally anything can happen in that group. Yeah. So can you speak to that?
I absolutely can. That's a very good point too. Just and quickly, the holding space thing. Like I like to think of it like I'm not holding space so much as space is holding me.
Yeah.
And when I get out of the way there, like then it becomes the space, not my space, you know. I think it, and also like the dealing with things that happen. Like I kind of love it in a way. Like I, in the beginning, I was very nervous and very scared of anything out of the ordinary because I was so structured and you know, like my. You know, my ability depended on how structured I was. And then when I learned to just let go and trust that whatever happens is perfect and amazing, then some amazing things have happened. So when there's a confrontation, which inevitably happens, you get a masculine, you know, some very, very macho guys who come into the room or, you know, guys filled with testosterone, guys come in who don't know how to, you know, who don't have boundaries. And so when something happens, like I generally will work with it. And I will generally work with the group. So I'll ask, if I'm, if, and I, I mean, the, I think the first time I really got this, where I really learned this, when I was facilitating in an addiction center, and a guy had come in, and an, I was going to say Indonesian guy, Indonesian guy, in the, oh my God, I can't even say the word now. Indigenous guy, how's that?
Indigenous,
An
yeah.
indigenous guy came in and he was under the influence. And he started challenging me and everything I was saying, and then started to get confrontational. And this, and the guy was, I could see he was wired, he was on something, he was high. So I just stopped at one point and went, because he started to get really disruptive. I just thought, okay, guys, can I just stop for a second? I want to ask the group, how do you feel about what's going on here? And then I just used that, and the rest of the group were like, well, actually, I think this is a, really disrespectful. We're not meant to be high when we come in here. Man, people are just trying to share and what's going on here. And then, so I just used the group. And then I said to him, bro, this isn't a judgment call about you, but it's not okay to come in here the way you are. And I escorted him. I said, best that you come back next week next time, when you're not under the influence. And I escorted him out and said to him, look, it's okay to come back, bro, but you just can't come in here and disrupt things like that. There's guys here who really want to do the work and who are doing their best to clean up. I mean, and bless this guy, because he came back the next week. And I'm talking about a group where people are there, they come from jail, and an outreach program from jail, some hardcore guys. And he came back and he apologized. And it was like, oh my God. So I really learned in that moment, it's okay to use the group there. And it's definitely not just okay, but it's imperative that I name what's going on. Like, I mean, even in the meditation, like if I, happens all the time. I'll just start the meditation. Somebody will start a chainsaw up right next door. And if I just avoid the chainsaw, I keep trying to meditate and talk about the, like all I do now is, okay, and just take in that chainsaw that's going on, beside us or behind us, and feel how you listen to that chainsaw. And what does it do to you? Does it throw you off your center, or does it bring, can you still remain in yourself and your integrity in your center while chaos is going out in the world? So utilize whatever's going on.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, we're going to jump around a bit, I'm sure. So you've touched on it. You have quite a story, and there's a you've written a book, written and published a book, around addiction and recovery. So I wonder if you'd like to just, as brief as you'd like to make it, really, what is your story here? Because I always feel the more we get to know somebody, the more it makes sense that they are doing what they're doing, right? Like, it's so flippant obvious. Like, it's so flippant obvious to me that you're doing what you do, right? It makes complete sense. Yeah, you're definitely in your zone of the kind of work that you do, from what I know of you. So yeah, I'd love for you to share like a bit of that backstory, and also, I don't know how intertwined it is in that, how you ended up in Bali, because you've been in Bali for how long now, is it?
10 years.
10 years. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I had no idea until later in life, obviously, that I was missing the love of a father. I had it, like I said before, I had a violent, abusive father and a very loving, nurturing mum, which I also didn't learn until later in life that that also was not so healthy, because she was looking to me for, for what dad wasn't giving her. So I also learned I had to be a very good boy, like, and as long as I behaved, and I had to do things for her in order for her to love me, to get the love. So I became a people pleaser, and especially with the feminine, I learned to give, not how didn't know how to receive. But yeah, I didn't realize that I started to hang around with alpha males all the time, like, so my dad was a big scary guy. So I started to hang around, gang members, and like, I mean, usually funny guys. I was a funny little kid, like, I was always very witty and very, very fun, which
know
got
that
me into
guy.
trouble a lot.
Yeah, I know that guy in you.
And very, very cheeky, like, nothing's off the table, which I love about humor. For me, humor can break anything, So, because I was funny, I used to be able to kind of get in with some of these big wigs. But then, like, I got to a place where I was, not happy in my, well, I don't know that I ever was for a long time. I was confident as a teenager, but then I kind of lost myself a lot. I wasn't what I would consider good looking or smooth or cool, or, it wasn't easy for me. I was definitely funny. So I think looking up to these guys and following these guys, I got involved in, like, in dealing and drugs and hanging around, riding Harley Davidsons and and with different gang members and stuff. And it was like very enticing, but I honestly feel like I never really fitted in there, you know, like it was a I tried to, I think they thought I was like a gay biker. Like I just didn't suit that scene. I felt very out of place. And yeah, but then I started to deal, and I started to, you know, then I started to use, I started to get by on my own supply, and then I got, you know, I started to get really bad. I promised myself I would never ever do needles, and you know, I was only snorting at first and going to parties, and you know, like, and the danger was is that when I, you know, was taking methamphetamines, when I took it, I was like 10 foot high and bulletproof. You know, like I thought I was the life of the party. And then, so obviously, the thing that I needed when I, because I didn't have confidence, every time I needed confidence, so I started to take the methamphetamines, which gave me confidence. But then, what I didn't realize it was sucking my soul in the sense that I thought I had zero. So the more confidence I gained from the meth, the less confidence and self-esteem and everything else I had as a man, you know, as a human being. So I started to use more and more and more and more until I got to a point where I couldn't do without it, you know. And I never ever really wanted to admit that, you know. And I in my mind, oh no, I'm not a junkie. I'm not even, I mean, I was shooting up multiple times a day, enough to kill me at times. And, you know, I had some serious, like I had an epileptic fit once, which I've never had before, you know, like in directly related to the drugs, couldn't drive for 2 years, had brain scans, and you know, but I was just so hooked on this drug, I couldn't live without it or do without it. I had to have it in me no matter what. It was like I couldn't even, I got to a point I couldn't face the world anymore. I couldn't even face going outside or people who were coming around unless I had it in my system. So it really got a hold of me, and yeah, it definitely took a bit to like to get over that. Like I actually had to leave the country, left Australia, went back to New Zealand, and to stop. You know, I remember the last hit I had was at the airport. It's all in my book and
Wow.
Shoot Up. But then I just switched that for alcohol. You know, I went to New Zealand, then I just became an alcoholic. I was doing like drinking slabs of Waikato beer every day, and then you know UDL cans, and I was in a job where you can get free alcohol, so. Like that was a very dangerous game as well. And then I just, yeah, like I became an alcoholic, and I kind of coerced my partner into it at the time. So the mother of my kids, and we both were doing that for a while until she went, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm done, you know. I carried on for a little while and then realized, yeah, you know, like this is not so good for me or my kids or, but I, then I just started swapping my addictions for better quality addictions, but I was still an addict, you know. I started going to the gym like 7 days a week. I'd have to go to the gym every day, and you know, I had the most ripped body I think I've ever had in my life, but I still never ever, I still felt broken inside, you know. I still felt like something was missing. And then, of course, then that was still affecting my relationship because gym was more important than my relationship. Gym was more important than the kids. So I was still an addict inside, yeah.
And I think, you know, what comes to mind is something that, one of my mentors helped me realize any compensating strategy for a perceived inadequacy will always strengthen the perception of the inadequacy. We're feeding the perception of that inadequacy by deploying the compensating strategy. Like there's a
Very,
we're
very true.
just sending a message to our subconscious, like, yeah, you need to do this because you're broken, as an example.
It's like sticking a band-aid over a boil that's continuing to fester and fester and get bigger and bigger, and I just keep changing the band-aid or putting more band-aids over the top. How's that for a gross image?
Right. So how was there like a single point in time that became the pivot?
There is one that wasn't necessarily to do with just the drugs, because I'd stopped the drugs and the alcohol. But I remember there was like I'd spent my whole life saying I'll never be like my dad. Like I will never ever be like my dad. You know, my dad was violent and angry. I'll never ever be like him. And then I remember one day having my son by the throat up against the wall, wanting to punch him in the face. And in that moment, like seeing this fear in my kid's eyes, you know, like, and I just remember going, what the fuck? I've just turned into my dad, you know? Like I've just turned into the very man that I said I would never ever become. And I realized, you know, I've got to do something about not just my anger there, but I've also, there's something to do with me, you know, having a determined fucking, you know, like life path. Never to be like my dad, but becoming like them, there's got to be something else going on here in the subconscious. So I started to delve and to look into my history, my past, my trauma, my childhood, and realize, holy shit, there's a lot of stuff there that I've just suppressed and not looked at and thought I was good, you know. I spent my whole life, I was funny, I was, you know, like, and I was just wanted to be fun to hang around. And anyone who had any drama would be like, no, that's just no drama, I don't need drama, you know, but I was just avoiding. I was, and I was only just managing to keep it all under the surface, you know. It became very strenuous.
So, just help me understand, like, time-wise, how does that fit in with you going to Bali? Like, what took you to Bali?
So I was in Australia for 20 years, so in Perth. So my drug use was around when my kids were born. So it would have been 27 years, I guess, 27 years ago. And then 10 years in Bali was me kind of, I left, I went to New Zealand for 5 years and then came back to, sorry, not Bali, came back to Perth for 10 years and then kind of a different. Started to experience a different life. I did this amazing process of, that I do now, quantum shift, which turned my whole life around. And then I started to work on myself. And then I went and volunteered in an addiction center and started to get to know why I was an addict and, you know, how I became an addict. And and all the light bulbs were like, oh my God, no wonder, you know, no wonder I am, like you said before. So it was very like enlightening. And also then I got to realize in the addiction center, I started to volunteer there and I started to realize, oh, I've got something here that's really, you know, really powerful and useful for these guys that I'm sitting with. I remember the first couple of groups I sat in, like I was sitting, like I said, guys who are from jail and, you know, like really hardcore dudes, like hardcore criminals. I remember sitting there going, first couple of groups saying, I don't really belong here, you know. This isn't, these guys are criminals, these guys are hardcore, these guys are druggies, they're junkies, and I don't belong here anymore. I've done all of that, I've cleaned all of that up. And then I think about the third time I went, I was sitting there going, actually, this is exactly where I belong. I am these guys and me, and I could see like the commonality, and they're just, you know, the expression of what they're doing is just coming from the exact same pain that I was dealing with and experiencing deep inside, you know. So it was a really good healing moment for me, you know.
It's funny you say that because
Yeah.
like I said, I went to that one men's group in October 2019 and didn't go anymore because I actually thought, oh my God, I don't really belong here. It's with all due respect because this was just my own blindness at the time. I was like, man, I'm nowhere near as fucked up as these. Like, I don't as these guys. You know, I just didn't feel that I fitted there. And yet, lo and behold, life showed me that that was exactly what I needed and what I benefit from, the brotherhood of that. It's so funny how life shows us that.
Yeah, amazing, eh? Yeah, and then doing that work, I think, like staying there and then actually becoming a facilitator, did the training there, facilitator training, suicide prevention. I worked there for quite a few years in the end. But yeah, just realizing that this gift that I had was actually not training necessarily, because like, or even all the training, it was just putting a word, a label onto, you know, stuff that I was naturally good at. And so I became, you know, I started to really enjoy facilitating and running groups, and I ran all kinds of groups while I was there. I did like men's groups. I even ran a women's group once because the facilitator didn't turn up. I was doing couples groups and parents groups and family of origin and then couples counseling, and started to really, really get a diverse understanding of, you know, of relationships and relating and you know, trauma and why people end up doing what we do. And then I started to study quantum physics, quantum mechanics. I did this amazing course with MJB seminars in Perth, which, you know, that's a thing that really shifted my life and changed my life. And it showed me that that's where I got to see that I was looking for my father's love, you know. If anyone had said that to me, he actually kind of said something similar before that. I was like, come on. My dad was an asshole. I wasn't after his love. But I realized that's what I was chasing the whole time was, you know, was looking for dad's love. And so, yeah, after many, many years and doing this work and starting to have my own practice and, you know, I opened up a clinic and started doing private sessions, I finally got the courage to leave a 20-year relationship and the mother of my 18-year relationship, sorry, mother of my children. That was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do because she'd forgiven me, you know, like for doing the drugs, you know, like because I'd hidden all of that from her in the beginning, and I'd had affairs and lied to her multiple times, and she'd forgiven me. And I was like, how dare I leave her? I can't, you know, I can't leave somebody who's forgiven me so many times. So in the end, you know, like we tried to do, we did couples counseling and we did seminars and workshops, and we tried to work on the relationship like 5 years. And then we got to a point where it was just like, I said, look, I'm just, this isn't working. And, you know, I'm holding you back. I'm holding me back. The kids aren't, you know, like they're not in a happy household. We're not in love. We're just, I know, I love you. I have love for you. Sorry, I love you. I have love for you, but I'm not in love. And, so yeah, it was one of the hardest things I had to do was to walk away from this relationship and break up my so-called happy family, and for the first time put myself first in a healthy sense. You know, like before I put myself first in a very selfish sense, like with the drugs and the alcohol, and you know, like it was always about me selfishly. This was the first time it felt wholesome. You know, like because I had no idea who I was, and I was, who am I outside of my relationship? Or outside, who am I outside of being a dad? Outside of the work that I do. So yeah, so I left the relationship, stayed in Perth for another couple of years, and my youngest daughter used to come and stay with me. The older kids didn't really want to. They had it very comfortable and easy at home. So I kind of lost that relationship with them a little bit. And but I had an amazing relationship with my youngest daughter. It was like I also parented her different because I'd done a bit of work on myself in that time. So we had a very, very good connection. And then I was sitting one day actually talking to my ex, and I mean, oh, bless this woman, she's a fucking angel, you know. Like, I remember sitting there saying to her, you know, if the kids weren't here, I wouldn't be in Perth. There's nothing here for me. It's not my home country. And, you know, I don't feel like a blonde here. It just doesn't feel like an energy. And she said, well, where would you want to go? I said, I don't know, but I was thinking maybe just go to Bali and have a look, you know, just to get out. And she goes, you know, I'll support you with whatever you want to do. Kids can come and visit you over there if you want. And I was just like, wow, you know, like, I've broken this woman's heart multiple times, and yeah, she is still very, very supportive of me and my life path. So, yeah, I came to Bali, and you know, I didn't think I was going to stay. I thought I'll just come and check it out, and here I am, 10 years later. Came for a
Well,
look.
you
I
know,
came for a
it's
look.
I came for a look as well. It's like I'd never even visited Indonesia, and I realized that I wanted to leave my life in England, now, but they were two separate things. Like wanting to leave this life that had felt stale, and stagnant and stale. And I was also running away. I wanted to run away from the pain and grief, which I couldn't do because I took it with me, of some friendships. One friendship in particular, which was at the time was nearly 4 decades old, you know, that had kind of fell apart. And now it feels like, okay, it's just came to a natural completion, I guess. But so it's like I was running away from this grief, but also, you know, I had other reasons of going to Bali, not least a young lady that, you know, I was very good friends with there. But it's funny because I'm sure there are hundreds, maybe thousands of people that feel, oh, I'll just give Bali a look. And there's something intoxicating about Bali, right? Gets under your skin. So before we started recording, I was sharing with you because the last 2 times I've been to Bali, I haven't been to Bali. I didn't go those times because I wanted to be in Bali. I came because, you know, I wanted to be with people there. And I do feel now my time for now in Bali is complete, at least for a while. And I laugh at myself in even saying that because for sure it gets under your skin. What I was sharing with you before we started recording was the thing I struggled the most with was the climate, I guess, there, and all the things that the climate brings. Mosquitoes seem to like my sweet blood. But I notice watching videos of Bali and seeing pictures and that, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. I'd love to be there. And you don't see the downside. You don't see the trash. You don't see the pollution. You don't see where it's overcrowded. And for sure, you and I were there perhaps during the pandemic. I think we probably were in one of the best places to be at that time, right? And
Was amazing.
it was amazing, and it was also devastating for so many people there. But it was incredibly unique, and you know, use that term, we kind of got spoilt. Well, it definitely felt like that way for me, you know, as the economy started to recover and tourism recovered there and things got more and more crowded, I think Bali now is a very different place to what it was even before the pandemic. What's your experience of that?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Definitely different pre-pandemic. It was a shame in a way too, because like during the pandemic, it was like, you know, everyone forgot about money because it's, I mean, tourism here, yeah, but and a lot of Balinese really struggled, lost businesses, lost houses, but the expats got together and supported. You know, we did fundraisers and people giving, you know, giving, we cleaned out our cupboards and gave, you know, whatever we could give. And everyone kind of supported everyone. And then it was interesting because the Balinese didn't see us as money or as, you know, dollar signs anymore. We started to really connect in a different way. And it was like Bali 20 years ago. You know, it was like, oh my God, the farmers went back farming, you know, like in Lembongan now you'll see they've restarted doing all of the seaweed farming because they didn't need to do that anymore because of, you know, tourism and they were making money off properties. So they weren't farming. Now that's all happening again. And it was amazing. And I was like, oh my God, I hope we remember this, you know. But as soon as the borders opened, it was like we completely forgot about how amazing life can be without money and how amazing life can be if we, you know, like if we remember each other and connect with each other in our hearts and the intimacy of life, you know. And a lot of that just got like thrown out again as soon as the borders opened. So it's kind of a shame. It feels like it's busier now here more than ever. It's like there's a strain on the infrastructure and, you know, like they just keep building more massive places and, you know, there's only a certain amount of water in the water table here and there's only one, you know, one, I think, power cable that comes across from Java, you know. So all of this is just getting strained to the max. So, yeah, it feels like things are very, very different here. We're actually talking about, maybe it's time to move on. We're going to head off soon and head back to me and my new wife. We're going to head to Perth for a few days, 10 days in next week, and then come back and possibly head to Europe.
Okay.
And start sharing what we do here and, you know, the stuff that we've learned and start taking that around the world and then maybe bringing people back for retreats, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't imagine like never visiting Bali again. Oh my gosh. Cause like it's definitely, it's part of me under my skin, even though there's a hell of a lot of stuff about Bali that I don't like and doesn't vibe with me, doesn't fit with me. I found, there's a lot of people come to Ubud to heal, find themselves and,
the mecca of the world.
Yeah. And I also feel, I would have never said this 5 years ago. So this is the Ubudian in me, but it does feel like also there's a spiritually polluted place. You know, there's a lot of people show up there and it can feel really messy. I feel like those 5 years. So I think in the period of 5 years, I spent three and a half years in Bali. I feel like it has shredded a lot of me that needed to be shredded. And then in a way, I think if I'd stayed much longer, it would have been overdue. I'd outstayed my spiritual welcome in a way as to what was good for me. Exciting to hear. Overcooked, for sure.
It's actually interesting because Ubud means like place of healing. So a lot of people do come here. Like it is an amazing place to heal. And you're right. Like
absolutely.
There's so many different modalities here. The place itself is very healing. They do, you know, ceremonies and they offer offerings and, you know, blessings all the time. There's water ceremonies and things happening all the time. And, I mean, it's a place that Mother Bali will either, you know, draw you in and keep you here or kick you out. So a lot of people will come here and have terrible experiences and like it's just like they've just been booted out. They just don't belong here. So one of the keys is, you know, to come in is, am I willing to do the work? Like I thought I was coming from Australia to here. Like I was running, at that time I was running amazing workshops and, you know, I was pretty well known in town and everybody knew who I was from what I did. So I thought, oh, I'm just going to go to Bali and open hearts over in Bali, you know? And when I came here, nobody gave a fuck about what I did. I was like, what? My God, who am I? I don't know who I am outside of what I'm doing and who I thought I knew. So I had to stay for the first year, like just being like Mama Bali, just stripped back everything I thought I knew about myself until I couldn't be fake. I think it's a place where I, you know, like I had to face me. I had to, discover not who I am in a label sense, because I still have no idea who I am, but I love it in a way. I remain open and ever changing and ever open to new ideas. But yeah, it was just like all these labels that I thought I had around myself were pulled back. And yeah, it was painful as hell, but amazing.
Gosh. Yeah, I say it's probably the best thing I've ever done in my life was, essentially just give up all of my life that I had in England and then move there. I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more to that. I feel like you already have started to, but what the hell, it's on my list here. I wanted to ask you, like, what is different about Dean now compared with 10 years ago?
Wow, very good question. I would say the most noticeable change that I have is that I'm not just content, but happy being me. In any moment, in any situation, like to know that, oh my God, all I need to do is breathe here and Dean's okay. Is like something I never ever thought I'd say. Like there's a safety in that, there's a security in that, there's a love in this that I didn't even know was possible.
Beautiful, beautiful. You'll have heard me share in Circle, right? That I feel I really like myself more now than I ever have done in my life. And I think I'm hearing that from you as well.
I like there's a distinction there too, as well, because I noticed a few times that I can love myself. I definitely love myself. And there's definitely times where I don't like myself. And to have that distinction, like to get to, like to like myself more and more and more and more as well, is also just as important. And the things that I and how do I hold myself when things aren't going well? How do I when life is knocking me down? How am I dealing with myself in those moments? Because I mean, at the end of the day, if I'm having a bad day, I'm having a bad day in paradise here. That's a pretty amazing place to have a bad day. But I still have bad days. I mean, I haven't. People think, people look at my life and, I'm sure it looks amazing and luxurious and, and it is. And I hear people say, oh, you're so lucky. And say, luck has nothing to do with it. Like, it took some work to be here, to get here, to be here, to stay here. And it's a work in progress. Like my wife keeps saying, we're a work in progress.
And gosh, so you remind me of a thought that I've had in Circle, which I'll share with you. And I hope I'm not burning any bridges here, but I know my brothers there will understand and forgive me if they feel that's necessary as well. So I think one of the first times I showed up in Circle, and just for the listeners, I have ensured that I've got your permission to share this. So it was at a time where I felt my partner wasn't making me a priority and giving me, due consideration. And I'm sure that happens in pretty much every relationship, quite frankly. And you shared this beautiful piece of wisdom with me. You said, and by the way, just like there's something here as well in the way you run the Circle, which I think is absolutely amazing and frustrating as hell at times as well, is that, it's a case of it's you nurturing a sacredly safe space. So, there's no advice giving. And I frustrating because there's been times when I've wanted to like say to people, oh, for fuck's sake, you need to grow a pair of balls or do the inner work, for fuck's sake, just go and do the inner work, right? You're kind of touching on that. You and I, we've done a lot of the inner work to get here. You said to me, you've noticed the times when you feel your partner's not making you a priority. What's generally going on is you're not making you a priority. And I was like, oh, fuck. Mm. Yeah, it really is down to me. And lo and behold, I noticed the more I honor what I want, then that is also reflected back to me. And now, the universe reflects back to me. You touched on your, I want to just check in with you. Whether you want to speak to that, because you do incredible men's work as well. And I've encouraged you, come on, Dean, at the end of the Circle, you please share the opportunity that there is here, people working with you. Right. So, but does that occur to you? Do you want to scream at somebody? Come on, just Phil, do the inner work.
In the beginning, mostly, like I definitely struggled with that. And then I learned that, if somebody told me what to do maybe 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have done it, or I wouldn't have discovered it in the way that I've discovered it. That whole, the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, but you can make it thirsty. So if I can make that horse thirsty and, guide them and ask the right question, which is what something I love about you. One of the things you do is you ask brilliant questions. You don't just give somebody an answer, So I think if I can ask the right questions and guide them into themselves and guide them to find the answer, then they are so much more empowered than me just fucking screaming the answer at them. So as much as I can, and this is why in the circle, the other magic that happens in the men's circle is we have reflection. So when somebody shares, we share from our own experience how that share impacted us, either in the moment or in, how I can relate to it in my life. So I think in that, the magic that happens is, oh my God, I'm not the only one going through this. I'm not alone. People
Oh
have
my
been through
gosh.
this. People are going through this. It's been going on for forever. We're pretty much, like a lot of the stuff we're going through is very similar. So then in realizing that, it's like, the gold, I think, in the, because it's an open circle as well. So the gold there is also, there's guys who are coming for the very first time, have never been to a group, been held by guys who have been there a few times, sometimes, like mid-range. And then there's also long-termers who have been there, who continue to show up and continue to come, not just for themselves and because they need it, but to support as well, to support, new guys. And it's a beautiful space, And I think, the life is a mirror, yeah? So like when I said about the, I realized, oh my God, I'm not making myself a priority. It was like I was meditating one day and I was like, I was stewing for weeks, she's not making me a priority. And I'd scream it out to her and, I would have arguments about it. Yeah, I'm not a priority. You're not making me a priority. I do everything for you. I make you a priority. And I'd prove all the points and show her on, the list of ways that I made her a priority. And then I was meditating one day and I was like, okay, Dan, come on, you know more than this. If the world is a mirror and if she's your mirror, where am I not making me a priority? And I just cried and I realized, man, I hadn't been going to the gym. I wasn't eating right. I was overweight. I was just wearing baggier clothes, feeling worse and worse about myself. And then the worse I felt about myself, the more I wanted her to try and fix me or to point out how amazing I was and that whole snowball. And then, yeah, when I realized that and I started to make me a priority, I mean, the next day I went to the gym, like as soon as I started making myself a priority again, I had myself back. I was back in me again,
So easy, is it, to for us to at least attempt to hold other people responsible for our unsavory experience of life, right?
Which is great to sit in group and have that pointed out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I made a note this morning. One of my friends on Facebook, he actually he shared, he's a real poet as well. He said, "The cure for immaturity is not always a beard and a good tattoo," which I thought was quite funny and very apt. And I remember you when the first time I left Bali, so gosh, like I said, I intended on just staying for 6 months, and then there was the pandemic, and I ended up being there just over a year and a half. And in honor of that, I didn't do it, by the way. In the end, I was actually going to get the outline of the island of Bali tattooed on my arm with the other island that I love, Zakynthos. I still might do that one day. And I remember you telling me, like, get a sleeve, get a sleeve. Your mum would be so proud to get a whole sleeve. I thought that was funny.
And a man bun.
Oh yeah, the pin on man bun. Yeah, I think that might suit me. And the kimono, of course. What do you think men want, Dean, with regards to women? So I saw somebody say recently, well, a time I'd fallen in the YouTube black hole, somebody was saying, actually it was a woman who was saying that she thought all men want is a woman who is sweet, kind, and who will support them. And that's actually what they find attractive. I thought, wow, I like that. How does that look to you?
Oh yeah, I don't know about that. Like when I hear that, I'm like, oh no.
No.
I think I mean, I want someone who's going to meet me in the places where I am not willing to meet myself, and still hold me in that place, and can still love me. Like when I'm in my worst, to be there with somebody else. Like when my partner's at her worst, I'm the same. Like I want to be there with her, show her light, and point out how amazing she is still in those moments. And I think that, the safety, the beauty, and and knowing somebody's fully committed, they're still in boots and all, in the worst moments is incredible,
And I agree, by the
So
way,
I
because
think
I think, yeah.
there's an acceptance, yeah. Like I want to be accepted for exactly who I am, exactly where I am, whatever's going on in my life. Just to know that I'm okay. I'm still me,
Yeah, for me, it is about being seen for who I am, irrespective of what stories I'm entertaining about myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who I
Most
really
important, I think.
am,
Yeah.
with compassion for being human, right? With the compassion for what it's like to be human, part of which obviously is to tell ourselves those stories and to feel shit about ourselves at times. Yeah, beautiful. You mentioned your wife. You have a little bit of a unconventional marriage. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, what that looks like? Because I feel. Again, this is probably a lot of the work that I do with my clients is help them to see the extent of conditioning, see the impact and the extent of conditioning, what the impact of that conditioning has on them being in touch with their deeper desires. And getting, therefore, once we see the extent of that conditioning, we can see beyond it and get in touch with the deeper desires. What is it we really want? Not the stuff that we think we should want to fit in, but really, what is it we really want? And you and your wife have found a way of relating that works for you. So could you like to share that with us?
Yeah, I'm very, very blessed to like to be with this woman I'm with now, and she's a gorgeous Brazilian. I never was interested in Brazilian. I never wanted a Latino. Like I always thought they were very a lot of drama, a lot of fire. And she's probably the most or the least Brazilian that I know. She's also done a lot of work. She runs women's circles. So she was actually asking for somebody. She said, to the universe, just bring somebody in who's like a glove, who can just fit on, fit over my life, my hand life. And she said she feels that's exactly what's happened is like we meld together very, very easily. And I think it's a testament to, to the fact that we've been willing to do the work and on ourselves to dig deep, to look, to continue to do that. And then, we have sharings all the time, regular sharings where anything that comes up, we can talk about anything. Nothing's off the table, like we, and not just bad stuff. So we have a sharing, not just when things are going bad. Oh, can we have a sharing? Otherwise, I'm like, oh no, I'm in trouble, But can we have a sharing? Yeah, let's have a sharing. And so we'll just sit and talk about whatever's present, So what I notice is present in my life, and I'll go through the different elements in my life. Well, physically, I'm feeling like, I'm feeling really good. I'm, like I'm exercising every day, and my body feels good, like and work-wise, like work's going well at the moment, and how I feel in our relationships. I kind of cover just what's happening in our life. And then sometimes it'll be just like, I just want to say, like, I'm so happy and content and I love my life right now and I love having you in my life. And I see what you did this morning and, like, I thank you so much for acknowledging me and appreciating me. So it's like a real affirming, but also stuff that's really stuff I don't want to say, like, I notice there's some resistance in me, like I don't want to share this in case it might hurt you. And then sharing it from that place. And then, before I would never talk about that because I didn't want to hurt them, but they could feel that I was hiding something and then it would affect my behavior or our behavior. And then she thought, oh, whatever I was hiding might have been 10 times worse, that I was interested in someone else. And all I was hiding was, oh my God, I'm annoyed that we can't, that we sleep together every night too, and it's annoying. I want to sleep by myself one night. Or so I think one thing we've created is space for each other, so space to share, space to talk. But also every now and then, we'll sleep separately. Like my Susanna had her own house. So we, even though we got married, I'll tell you about the marriage, the unconventional marriage in a sec, we lived separately and that worked amazingly well because we would have one or two nights where we just slept separately. As soon as Susanna left, I would miss her and I love missing her, we have stuff to share and talk about all the time. It's, keeps our life interesting. So now we're living together. We still do that. Susanna went and slept somewhere else last night. Just to, recharge at night and regenerate and be in our own space is so important. So the marriage, we did a sacred union ceremony. So my wife, my lovely wife, is also amazing at rituals. She's very, has a very full, rich life in terms of rituals and doing little ceremonies. And So she wanted to, she knew that she'll just get downloads, you know. She's very intuitive and she'll get downloads and go, we've got to do something on this summer solstice or on the 20th. She told me a while ago, 22nd of September, we're going to do something for us. And I was like, what? And she goes, I don't know, we're just going to do something for our relationship. And I was like, do I get a say in this? And she said, no, we've been told we're going to do it. So it was, we ended up just saying, oh, let's do a little kind of a sacred union ceremony. Now, it was meant to be like a little engagement in our mind, you know, like pre-wedding, whatever. But so we were telling our friends, and then our friends in Limbongan, where we'd lived during COVID, we didn't know we were wedding planners, you know. So they went, yeah, let us help you with that. And then this, it just became this beautiful, like beautiful, beautiful. Like they set up the beach for us. They did an arbor, you know. They decked it out. They had we had a came in on a boat that was decked with flowers and a drone coming over the top. It was at sunset. It was probably one of the most perfect days of my life. And it was just like this magical. I wasn't, you know, the thing I always thought I would be nervous at a at my wedding, you know, like and even though it wasn't like an official wedding as such, you know, I gave speeches and stuff. At no point throughout that day was I nervous. Like I was, I even when I spoke, you know, and I don't wasn't drinking, so it was like I just spoke from the heart, and I realized the people that were there. You know, we're just people that I love. You know, we had a, maybe 30 people, I think, that were there. It was like just very, very, very good friends and allies. And it was like the most magical, magical day. And then, you know, the photos were are incredible. People see the photos and they hear the story. They're like, oh my God, can you do this for us? And Susanna's like, yeah, this is what she wants to do, is like do these rituals and little ceremonies for people. So
Beautiful.
not officially in a sense of the word. And I mean, the thing that I'm most proud of with myself is that the man I had to become to want to do this, because I'd never wanted to be married. I mean, I was with the mother of my kids for 18 years. She always wanted to be married. I didn't want to be married, because I used to go, oh, who needs a bit of paper? You know, I don't need a bit of paper to define my relationship. And the truth is, I was just never, ever committed in a relationship. I always had one foot in and one foot out, because I thought I was going to miss out if I commit to the one. And then I didn't realize with Susanna, when I met Susanna and I fully committed, I was in boots and all, you know, I was like, my God, I love this woman. I'm here. This is it. I had all of these insecurities come up. Oh my God. So I still had a lot of work to do on myself. And I didn't realize the safety, though, in like having no leaky energy, no leaky sexual energy, no flirting, no, you know, no messages on the side, like shutting any of anything that happens. Even if I'm talking to a woman, if Susanna's not around, and I can feel her flirting, I'll shut it down straight away and just bring up my wife. Yeah, my wife, you know, like an old, and it, there's such a beautiful safety in that that I didn't realize I was missing my whole life.
I love how you and Susanna have created your own form of marriage, right? That's it, really, isn't it?
And why not, eh?
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, I know that's kind of a rhetorical question, but to me, it's like, well, why not? It's because we're brought up to comply, right? And that's a whole thing that I know that's a subject that you're more willing to go to than me. It's not one that I particularly enjoy. It's like, yeah, okay, but that does remind me, like you have this beautiful, wonderful, mischievous sense of humor, by the way, and there's some of the things you will post. I'm not going to repeat even any of it, but I'm not going to repeat any of it. Holy shit! How can you even post that? It is, I once I got what's the word? Scolded actually because I had posted something about, and again, I think if you're offended by a joke, there's generally a misunderstanding. And I'm gonna lay myself open here probably for criticism. The joke was something like, and it was when I was in the US, and I took a picture and posted a picture of this sign on the wall, which was in a bar, and it said something like, "Drink your beer. There are sober children in Africa." Now, to me, I saw the funny side of that. That's not taking the piss out of, you know, children in Africa. That's
No.
actually a piss take on the absurdity we have of that saying. We've probably all been like, you know, brought up, you know, eat your food because there's starving children in Africa, and it never really made sense to me. So, like, to me, that's actually a dig, a humorous dig at the absurdity of that. But again, one of the things I kind of admire and also wince in equal measure is your willingness to share humor. Has that got you in any sticky spots?
Oh, bro, like every day. I think I can't remember how many now consecutive 90-day bans. Like I'm in deficit. Like I've got to wait before I can share. Like I couldn't do a live the other day. And I mean, yeah, in the beginning it was very hard. And this, I mean, imagine like if you're wincing. Imagine like sometimes I'm like, oh, can you imagine the ones that I don't post?
Oh my
I
gosh.
have certain select friends that I just send these ones to. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm not going to put that out. I'll send it to a friend. For me, though, Phil, humor's the most important, breaker of tension. And, I don't share anything for, to offend anybody at all. Like I joke about myself. I put myself in that category and I'll laugh at myself, joke at myself, well, like, and my own upbringing and all the stupid things that I've done in my life, So it's, for me, it's the best form of relaxation, the best form of, like I'd rather laugh about something than fight about something. Like, and for me, nothing's off the table. Like I'd rather, I think there's definitely something that happens when people can laugh together. Even, some of my, I mean, my humor is very inappropriate sometimes. And my kids have the best senses of humor, very inappropriate, but I fucking love it. Like we, like I can't help if somebody wants to get offended. I feel nowadays people are looking to be offended. Because it gives them a right to something, but it doesn't heal them. It doesn't help them. It doesn't fucking, like it kind of gets people into a fight that's not even their fight, just for something to do. I think we're just bored shitless because we don't look at ourselves and want to deal with our own problems and our own life, And if everyone did this more than trying to get offended by everyone else, it would have a different world. But yeah, again, another story. I love humor.
It's just me too. Me too. Fasting, by the way, that was the first time I met you. I reached out to you. Had been following you, and by the way, I don't know if you know this. I was a bit scared of you, by the way, because when I came to Bali, I've joked in circle many times. I didn't realize how much work I had to do on myself until I arrived in Bali. And also there's a more humorous way of saying that as well, is I didn't realize how broken I was until I came to Bali, because you can get bombarded with, there's a, well, as one example, I sent it on to my partner, by the way. It's like how to poop like a goddess. Like you've mentioned, there are workshops and everything for literally for all aspects of life, you know. And so that pretty much sums it up. But anyway, fasting, I reached out to you. You were doing like a 40-day fast. And and I've done, I don't know, 6, 7, maybe 5 day fast, and I did a 7 day fast. Absolutely incredible. How the hell do you manage to fast for 40 days?
I think I had built up to that, so I'd done loads and loads of smaller ones. I think the longest one I'd done before that was 31 days. And this was fasting on just water and coconut water. So drinking maybe one or two coconuts every 2 or 3 days. But I'm, like smashing the water, like 5 or 6 liters of water and getting sunlight and lots of rest and, but there's, like it gets easier and easier. Like what happens after, they say after 3 days of just water fasting, like you go into a process where your cells start to eat unhealthy cells in the body. So they start to clean the body itself. They say even it can reset the DNA, your DNA codes and, digestion takes the most amount of energy from the body. So after maybe 4 days, it takes 3 or 4 days to detox, headaches, massive headaches, feeling like crap, withdrawals. I mean, going through exactly what a junkie would go through, in detoxing. So very full on. But around about the fourth or fifth day, like I realized having so much energy in my body because, I'm not digesting anymore. So then the body can focus on replenishing, rejuvenating the blood, dumping toxins and actually healing. And you can't be in growth and like fear energy at the same time. So when you're not in like when you're not consuming food, you're in this growth energy, which is some amazing, amazing energy. So then the clarity I have so much more clarity, so much more focus, so much more energy. And it's amazing. And there's times where it's like, oh my God, after a period of time, it's easier just to not eat. And then I realize how much of my life is consumed around food. Like I'm standing at the fridge, every meeting I have, it's around a cafe, what time, and it's around a time, it's lunchtime, whether I'm hungry or not. Oh, it's lunchtime, we've got to eat. That's like such a weird thing. And so, and cleaning the body out, like I got to the when I was doing the longer fasts, it became so easy. I had to train myself to eat again, like to break fast. Like there's a whole process in breaking fast where I had to, especially the 40 day, where I just would, and started to introduce maybe a capful of juice into a bottle of water, and did that over the next couple of weeks until I was able to have just a full juice, Yeah, very, very. I mean, that's an intense one. I definitely recommend if people are going to do a longer fast to get some help. And going into a fast is just as important as the fast, and then coming off the fast is just as important as going into it. So definitely get some help. But it's something we should all be doing, bro. Like it's a great. I mean, if I can't take, I and this is the reason I did the month fast, the 40 days, was if I can't take 40 days out of my whole life, 58 years so far, to clean my body and dedicate that to my body, then, what can I do,
Yeah, beautiful. Love the way of looking at it. Dean, I could talk to you all day. Where can people
I think
find
we
out a little
have.
bit? Yeah, where can people find out a little bit more about you? What have you got on offer, at the moment?
Best place would be my Instagram page. Integrated Man with Dean, my business page, not the one where I share all the naughty memes. Integrated Man with Dean, and I have men's oracle cards that I've created on there. I have a book called Shoot Up, which is a talks about my life, a bit of an autobiography of how I became a junkie, my family life growing up, and then how I became an addict, and then how I turned that around to be kind of doing what I'm doing now.
Beautiful. That's in the show notes, links in the show notes, people. God, as I said at the beginning, when I see you, oh man, I wish I was back in Bali. So hope that we do get to meet up again. Really feel like you are one of my brothers, actually, for sure. It's always felt like I
Before we
was,
wind up, can I ask you a question, Phil?
Go
Sorry,
for
bro,
it.
because I think I've asked you this before, and I loved your answer, and it's a good one for men, I think. So, what's the hardest thing about being a man nowadays?
Loneliness.
Hmm.
And in answering with that, I also recognize that, like, that's a real experience that many men have, the feeling of loneliness. And it doesn't have to be that way. I think we all struggle as well with, to varying degrees, with ideas of what it is to be a man. In the same way as I think a lot of controversial, maybe, I think the idea of romance is the biggest threat to any relationship, right? And in the same way, that also applies to the ideas that we have. We can have romantic ideas really about what it is to be a man. And so for me, in my dark time of feeling really lonely and disconnected just from who I am as a man, and getting so caught up and lost in the story of who I thought I needed to be and wasn't, reaching out to you and coming to Men's Circle helped me to bring love to my inevitable failure to be the man I thought I needed to be in order to be loved.
Ooh, very, very good answer. I like that. Yeah, very powerful. And that loneliness can be like lonely in a sea of people, lonely in a relationship,
Absolutely.
lonely in many ways. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Sorry, bro,
Thank
didn't mean to interrupt you. I just
No,
wanted
thank you for
to hear that
asking.
one.
Yeah. Thank you for
Yeah.
asking. It feels good just to revisit that. Yeah, I've got a similar feeling now, how I would feel at the end of Circle, right? Just this
Yeah.
beautiful
Yeah.
appreciation, connectedness. It's just this beautiful feeling. So anybody who listens to this, if you're a man, you visit Bali and you can get to Ubud on a Wednesday night, at least whilst you're around, Dean, and after, because I'm sure it will continue after you've left as well. Just go, give it a go for sure. Any final words from you? What's your message you'd like people to get from our conversation, Dean?
Yeah, I think that same thing, Phil. Like I just did we had a Bali Spirit Festival, a massive festival here, and I ran a men's circle there. There were like I think nine guys that had never been to a men's circle, and like you know, like the feeling of their nerves and oh my god, what's this? This is a bit weird, you know, when they came in, and they all said like at the end they were like, oh my god, I feel like you guys are my brothers. Like I feel like you know me. Like and within that was an hour and a half, you know, like the sense of oh my god, I am not alone. Like I am. There's this magic that happens when I open up and share and talk about real shit, you know, not just sports and cars and motorbikes and guns and, you know, but when I open up and talk about my relationship and my struggles and my deepest fears and struggles, you know, like there's something really magical that happens there.
Gosh. Thank you, Dean. Look forward to giving you a hug, be it in Asia or in Europe.
Sama, brother. Thank you so much. See you, bro.
Oh, what a beautiful man Dean is. I miss him whenever I'm not in Bali. My apologies, by the way, for the quality and imbalance of the audio in this episode caused by me not performing my usual basic checks before starting recording, meaning I was only able to use a single combined audio file. I think I was just super excited to connect with my dear friend in Bali. And I hope that hasn't taken away any of your enjoyment from this conversation. As always, I'd love to hear from you. If there's something you'd like to share relating to this conversation, this podcast, or indeed any of the work that I do. And you can help other people find this podcast by leaving a review on your preferred podcast platform. Thank you again for listening. I wish you much love, prosperity, and joy.